Shoot the Defence, the best podcast in the world. We're at it.
I keep saying Henry's a forward.
Richie, who's the best striker you've played against?
Henry.
And the fact that we are now taking our country and put our country on the map of world soccer, being the first African nation, the third world nation in the whole world to win an Olympic gold medal in soccer, you know, it was unbelievable.
If you're going to take the time to go and get a pig head and break my locker open and wrap my clothes in it, that's sending a different message to me.
I've had to protect my family from going out into the street because you'll have random people that just coming up and abusing them racially. Even some old school managers who are British, they still have the same racial undertones like the man in the street who they're trying to condemn.
Hello and welcome to a world exclusive edition of Shoot the Defence. Today's guest is no stranger to us and he's someone who's become a friend of the show over the years. I'm thrilled to say that Shoot the Defence are the first podcast to talk to our guest extensively about his latest book, a book that I'm certain everyone who picks it up and reads it will thoroughly enjoy. Having been granted advanced view of the book, I can say it's an absolute cracker. True genius, George Best, is the definitive family-backed account of the remarkable career of one of Britain and world football superstar talents and personalities. Published to coincide what would have been George Best's 75th birthday, it charts his entire football career. It is author Wayne Barton's 15th book with a Manchester United theme, and anyone who has read any of his books can only nod in agreement when he is described as a preeminent writer on the club. Of course, George Best did not only play for Man United, and there is plenty in the book for fans of other teams he played for, but it cannot be denied that Best shone brightest while at United, and a large part of his football life is interwoven with the history of the club. Drawing on more than 30 new and exclusive interviews, Wayne goes into unparalleled depth to tell George Best's complete football story for the first time, of how the lad from Craigar, Northern Ireland, became a footballing and cultural superstar. It charts the games, the goals, the glory. This is the untold story packaged beautifully with a stunning cover. Onto the show, and welcome, Wayne. How are you?
Hi, Mark. I'm not bad, thank you, mate. In that heady mix of excitement and anxiety that always comes in the week of a book release, but delighted that I'm kicking off that period talking to you.
Brilliant. Thank you for that. Let's first start with what I said in the intro, that the book explores Best's career. And while there's been so much written about him, what sets his book apart is that it is the only biography given a blessing by his family and the George Best Foundation. So the first question is in two parts. Why a book on Best, and why did it come to pass that you got access to George's family?
Yeah, great question. You're always good with your questions, but Mike, that's a cracker to start with. Okay, so why George? There's probably been a period of time over the last few years where I've been really lucky to have my work published, really lucky, and I don't take that for granted. I say that a lot on social media, and I think people just, you know, think those words are token, but they're not. So getting to that process of being in a position where you can choose what you write about is one thing. And as a United fan who likes to write books, I'd like to write on everyone. This might sound stupid. I would, honestly, give me the chance to write a book about every single player that played for us, I'm going to do it. And obviously, at the top of that hit list, you've got players like George. So it was always an ambition that someday I want to write something about George. But it then comes to the point of earlier on in my career, I had a few ideas for different books to write, like the Fergie's Fledglings and the Jimmy Murphy and things like that, and the opportunities fell that way. Writing a book on someone like Eric Cantona or George Best, it's something that you almost have to work towards if you want to get the right context to tell the story that you want to tell. And that's where the second part comes into it, because it's, all right, well, once you've decided, everybody wants to write a book on George Best, how do you do it? What angle are you going to take to add, like you said, there's been so much already written about him. So where do you go about starting that? What do you want to write about? What do you think that you can do that's going to add to what's already out there? And it came down to me, and as you know, because you've read my books, just a book about his football was the thing that was missing from the library of George Best, basically. A book that concentrates just on his football as much as you can within the parameters of his life. You know, you can't be negligent of some things that happened and the impact that they had on his career. But I still felt that there was this massive part, really, of his career where you could talk about just his football. So that's what I wanted to do with that. And that sort of took me onto this path where his family got involved. First of all, I should say as well, even at the point of saying, oh, I wanted to write a book about George Best, I still had to be convinced to do that. I've got a friend, Dan Burdett, who is so valuable to me as a friend, but also as a sort of confidant for anything that I write or work on. And it was actually him who said to me, he said, you know what, you should write that book on George now. And I had a moment of hesitation. I thought, oh, am I ready to do that? And then it was a matter of thinking, am I ready to do it? What can I add that's different? And I talked to my wife and she's saying, no, yeah, actually, it sounds like a good idea. And those two are normally people who are very good at telling me if something's a good or bad idea, mm-hmm. you know, and whether or not I should work on it at that moment in time. So they both sort of give their thumbs up. So we had a little sort of talk about the things that could be done. Obviously, the football, the pure football aspect of it was one. And then the second aspect was, yeah, like you said, getting his family on board, which is a complicated process. I didn't really understand that before I got involved with it, and obviously it's their relationships are their relationships. I didn't realise that it was quite so complicated, and I with the best of intentions, got in touch with as many people as I could mm-hmm. To tell them of my intentions to write this book, and you know, that I was already working on it at that point. It was mm-hmm. going to be written. But I thought what will really give it the seal of approval is if they see that I'm writing a book that's celebrating George, that isn't talking about this controversial side of him without neglecting it, isn't really talking about his illness or anything like that mm-hmm. in that kind of detail. And would they be interested in sort of championing a book like that? And there were reservations. Some members of the family were really excited about that, just the prospect of what I was trying to do with that, and others were a little bit hesitant because they've heard it all before, and you know, they've sort of given approval and back into some projects before that have come out and haven't been great, mm-hmm. Haven't been very generous towards George, and they will have felt like they were let down, and perhaps that in a way that was letting George down, you know, because of the nature of those projects. But so obviously they didn't have to trust me from the start. They could have easily just said, we don't trust anyone to do anything. But we sort of, I came around full circle on that. I said, you know, obviously I've worked with Jimmy Murphy's family and mm-hmm. and there's all this, you know, I've got a track record at least for what it's worth. And obviously, there was the other side of that, is that you don't have to, don't expect you to sort of say yes straight away if you don't feel comfortable with it, but wait until I've finished the thing, you know, wait until I've finished it and have a read of it and tell me what you think then. So when I got a first draft together, that's when I kind of got a universal backing from everyone that I spoke to. And they, you know, his sister and brother provided a foreword for the book, mm-hmm. Which I know that you've read. So that so that's how that came around, basically. And, you know, then because I had the family back in, it was kind of like, oh, I've really got to be careful that I'm doing justice to George now, you know, because obviously it's representing their faith, basically. And yeah, that's how that came about. I know it's a long-winded answer, but it's kind of like it was a long-winded process to get to that. You know, obviously there are a lot of people in George's family, a lot of different people and very strong characters in their own right. But I have, when I you know, obviously the relationships are all complicated, I would say that everyone, I've managed to iron over any creases with everyone. I think I have. I'm happy with the way that the book represents George, in at least that it's as faithful to what I said I was going to deliver as it could be. And, you know, there are certain members of the family who have been really supportive. You know, I've got to say a word. Ian, his brother, supported me all the way through and has contributed. He talked to me for the book, shared some stories. Callum could not have been more supportive.
That's his son, isn't it, Callum?
Callum's his son, yeah. And obviously having his son's sort of backing to sort of say, you know, I appreciate what you're trying to do for my dad, is like, it's massively emotional
That's
for
amazing.
Me.
That's amazing.
It's actually this end process of sort of getting the book and everything and sort of getting it ready has been one of the most emotional processes of it, you know, because working on it has just been like a juggernaut going all the way through. And getting to this point has just been incredible. So it is one of those where I don't know if everyone has read everything. Ian sent me a message today saying that he's read it and he's delighted with it. So he got copies at the same time as I did. And it's now a case of waiting for other things to come out, you know, if everyone else is happy with it. So, you know, touch wood that they are. That's the most important thing for me, that they feel that I've represented George faithfully.
No, that's brilliant. I mean, as I said, I've read it and I'll always give my review at the end of the interview. But as I said at the beginning, you know, I think it's a cracker. I've told you off air, you know, what I think about it. I thought it's a really good read. And I think what you just said there, you know, there's an honesty and a transparency, which I think, you know, because of what you've done in the past, because how you handle yourself, Wayne, I think it's great that they trusted you and you've come through. So, which is fantastic. So well done. And I guess you've sort of answered the next question, but I'm still going to ask it in the way that I want to ask it. Mm. I mean, George Best's life and football career is often claimed to have been a tale of what might have been. I mean, even now, with so much access to footage and so much evidence, what I would say to the contrary, I believe there is a laziness in evaluating a career which brought so many highs and so much. So for me, what comes out from the book is actually, and you said it, as a celebration of what George did achieve. And there was so much that he did accomplish. I mean, he famously said, "Remember me for my football." And by God, there's so much to remember, isn't there? And as a reader, that does come out for me. And was that the forefront of the story that was told for me? Was this a conscious effort for you to write it in this way? Are you happy with the way it came out?
Yeah. And yeah, I am. That's it, precisely what I wanted to do with it. You're absolutely right. You've got it absolutely bang on with that. And it was probably that principle in mind that was the sort of genesis of the idea, really. You know, going back to that and saying, yes, all right, let's talk about all the could have beens and everything like that, but turn the argument around and say, let's celebrate what was. And when you put the career into perspective, he's played nearly 500 times for United. He's scored 170 odd goals. That he, you know, his career was longer than Cantona. It's longer than Ronaldo's. Do you know? So when you look at, I mean, I'm talking his career at United was longer than that. So instead of saying, you know, and Cantona and Ronaldo will rightly dominate those conversations about who's the best player ever, and nobody looks at Cantona and says that's a waste of a career. Certainly nobody says that of Ronaldo. And I mean, you and I both witnessed every single year of Ronaldo's career at United, and we know that the first 3 years were pretty hit and miss. Yes. It wasn't a guarantee that he was going to make it. But you look at it, you don't look at those first 3 years. You say, oh my God, he had 6 years of brilliance, and that was kind of what I wanted to do with the George Best story, is that, no, let's reframe it. Let's celebrate how bloody brilliant this player was and how lucky that we were as a club and as a country to have this player who, I mean, wherever you stand on how great he is in the global ranking, certainly the best British player of all time, and a player who had such ingenuity, he had such craftsmanship, he was so good, and we don't celebrate him in the same way. And it was such a weird thing that, you know, I completed the book and I started writing my acknowledgements you know, obviously, a thank you for Mike Pieri in prominent place in there. But I started writing it on the. It happened that it was on the anniversary of George's passing last year, and I was writing it, and then the news came through that Diego Maradona died, and I thought, what a strange. Some things are, you know, a lot of things in life are coincidence, and some things are too strange for it to be coincidence. And I felt this was one of those things, and it did put a different perspective on it, because I looked at it and I thought, again, regardless of whether or not you think Maradona's better than Best or anything like that, the point is that when Maradona passed, the reverence was incredible. Nobody talks about the negative side of him. Nobody talks about the drug addiction. They just, Argentina was in mourning, but they also, it was like a, I wouldn't say celebration, but it was like a carnival. It was so crazy. You looked at the scenes there and they were all celebrating the life of their greatest ever player. And in Britain, they didn't, I know there was a celebration and there was a mourning for George on the day that he died, but it was so intrinsically, everything's always linked to his drinking. And I felt all of these things, you know, which forced me to write the book, basically, and tell it in the way that I wanted to tell it, is those kind of principles, you know, like, yeah, let's stop dominating this conversation about George with his illness. Let's stop dominating it with, oh, he's wasted potential. Let's look at how good he was, and let's celebrate what he was, because we only had it for a short time. Even if he'd have played 12 years at his absolute physical peak, it would have still have only been a short time for us to sort of have that opportunity to be blessed to witness that and have that for club, country, just to witness as a football fan. So that was really the genesis for why I had to write in the way that I had, the way that I did.
And from what you said just there in terms of the reverence of Diego Maradona, I think a lot of people are going to be happy to read this book and to read it purely as a celebration of his football. I mean, I did a quick search and I stopped counting after about 22, the number of books that have been written on George Best, and there must be more. And in chapter 17, you start by writing, quote, "There is a fine line between reality and illusion," end quote. So how difficult was it then to separate the hyperbole from fact?
Okay. Do you know what? I don't think it was, because what I decided at some point was that, and I think it's something that I say in probably the last passage of the book, basically, is you just have to trust, you just have to relay the story in the best way that you can articulate it, and hope that the reader trusts in what they're reading, that they are trusting the words and the recollections of the people that shared this period of time with George. Because if you can just articulate it in the way that other people are sharing it, and try and be eloquent, and try and be verbose, and try and dress it up and, you know, put it across in the most effective way that you can, without embellishment, then the truth speaks for itself. Do you know that, you know, George Best scored from a corner kick because he intended to score from a corner kick? Now, those are just words, really, but when you consider the individuality and the fact that nobody does that these days, even that short sentence tells you so much about a player that probably was underappreciated at the time, lost in this sea of celebrity. You know, you didn't really appreciate what he was doing, because nobody scores direct from corner kicks. Even if they did it once, I mean, he did it twice or three times in his career. And he tried it more times than that. Nobody does that. No. And we're talking Messi, Ronaldo, any player in the world since George hasn't tried stuff like that. So you just have to say what happened And yes, try and do it in the most articulate way that you can, but don't embellish it. Because if you embellish it, you run the risk of making it sound unbelievable. And the problem is, with George Best, there's probably a lot of people who are going to read it and think half of it is embellishment. Do you know what I mean? That he couldn't surely have done that. And I'm like, no, this is exactly what happened. There was a time where he set up two goals without wearing his boot.
Yeah.
It happened. Do you know? And this is the way that it happened. And these are the you know, the talk about... I might well be covering ground that you're going to come to, but you know the quote from Alex Stepney, he was so quick that he learned how to beat the foul.
Yeah
things like that. They're just things that now the players don't have to do. That they don't have to do that, they just have to be quick enough of mind to deceive an opponent. He didn't have that protection in those days, and I don't want to sound like one of those football was different in those days, because a player could do that today if they chose to, because everything's there for them to do it. All the best facilities are there for them to develop that speed of thought and intelligence to be able to be better than an opponent. And few players are... I mean, I think it just came naturally to George. That's the thing that was so good about him, that it came naturally. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's where I was with it. Just put it across as plainly as you can. In the best way that you can write it, of course, but without embellishment, and just trust that the reader is going to believe that one football player was capable of this absurd, absurd brilliance.
And I'll tell you what I did while I was reading the book, and when you describe certain goals and certain events, and even though I remember them, I mean, you describe them beautifully, and even though I remember them, I can see them in my head, I went on YouTube. And I thought, right, I want to see it again. And it's what he actually did do that. He did do, you know, he did score that goal against Tottenham. He did score against Benfica away the way you described it. And it's like, wow. And it's you know, YouTube is a great accompaniment to a book like this, I guess, because, you know, we don't get to see it every other day on, you know, rolling news channels and so on. So absolutely. Yeah. So that's a tip for anyone, to have YouTube nearby when you're reading the book. And I mean, you alluded to something earlier about the boot in the hand, and there was a mischievous and cheekiness to George, which anyone who knew anything about George Best would know about. And the book includes so many examples of that, which I'm glad about. And there are so many great stories about George, both about his, you know, on his exploits on and off the pitch. But one anecdote that stuck in my head and was one that you quote John Fitzpatrick, the former Aberdeen fullback, who he arrived at United same summer as George. And from the book, you quote Fitzpatrick, who tells us, Best said to him, and quote, "Fitzy, I'm going to beat everybody and smash it into the corner." He gets the ball, goes past one, then two, three, four, five, puts in the corner, runs back to the halfway line and says, "Told you, didn't I?" End quote. I mean, that's just wonderful. And that was George, wasn't it? I mean, that's my favourite. What is your favourite story of that ilk?
That's a great one. It really is a great one. I love Brilliant. That. But that's the thing about it was, it was mischievous, but there was no malice in it. Jim Ryan says that he would nutmeg him in training and then laugh while he was going past. You know, just because he could do it, and because he was trying different things and stuff like that. You know, the story of him chipping Harry Gregg in training, and Harry Gregg, I mean, if only there was footage of Harry Gregg chasing George Best around the training pitch.
Yeah,
stuff like that. I think that probably the Jim Ryan one of him practicing the corners is good. Do you know? Yeah. And then watching him do it in a morning, and then seeing him score one in a match is just extraordinary stuff. John Fitzpatrick, obviously, he speaks so glowingly of George. Well, he did. Obviously, he passed while in the time that I was writing. So he. Everyone who was with him at youth team level, do you know, speaks of him in that way. And there's so many stories. A couple of the Jim Ryan ones are, but I think that Fitzy one is brilliant, isn't it?
I mean, fantastic. Yeah. It comes on quite early in the book, but it just stuck. And then there's, I mean, and the nutmeg on Cruyff. I mean, that's brilliant as well.
Oh yeah, yeah. That was George with something to prove, wasn't he, at that point? Almost absolutely. To himself.
And, you know, talent is never enough for, you know, sportsmen and sportswomen. Hard work plays a very important part in any success that they strive to achieve, as we know. And again, early in the book, Wayne, you tell the reader how by watching the great Alfredo Di Stefano and his almost omnipresence on the football pitch, that made a lasting impression on a young George Best. Do you think that shaped his work ethic on the pitch?
Yeah, because what he was seeing was the best player in the world, the most illustrious name in the world, because obviously this is a time when you didn't get to see the great players. Mm. You only heard about them, and everybody knew Di Stefano was, obviously they did. So when he came to United, or he came to Manchester and he played in the way that he did, completely bossing the game against an improving United side, but looking as fantastic as he did and working so hard, it made such a profound impression on George, because you could almost trace the difference in him from that point. Because before that, it was almost like, it seems like, yeah, he knew that he had the ability and he knew that he probably had the beating of his peers, but it was almost like, if it's good enough for Di Stefano and I can see how good he is, I already know the difference that can make to my game. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you've said it there, covering every blade of grass. One thing that is not often said about George, but just about everyone in the book did say a variation of this line, was how hard he worked and how he could play in every position now, and how he was the complete player. Mm. And as you know, again, having read it, I talk about people's perception of complete, because it's so different in today's day and age. People just think of, when you say a player's complete, you just think they've got everything that is needed to succeed in that position. Mm-hmm. When people are talking about George Best as a complete player, they're talking about him playing anywhere on the pitch and being the best player. Mm. And it's so difficult to comprehend that, again, it's one of those things that you kind of have to watch the footage of him again to rewatch what he's doing. Like you said, maybe watching the footage of the goals and then saying, you know, the Spurs one, and he gets it over four players.
Wow.
And I'm saying, well, you could have probably put another player in there and he would have got it over. And then you watch it and you think, well, yeah, you're probably right. And maybe even another one after that. He was that accurate and he was that good. He was the complete player, and it did come from Di Stefano, and, you know, the imagination side, probably from Ento as well, you know, the Real Madrid player.
So
two greats who had this definitive impact on George's career, having just witnessed them, you know, at close hand at Old Trafford. And, you know, it just goes to show that a player can be as individually brilliant as George. And even, you know, who knows where he would have been without that sort of influence. But knowing that he had that definitely shaped him. You could see that it did. Because of the countless number of videos that we can see of George working hard to retrieve the ball. And the way that he played in every position, the way that he came deep, and, you know, like, a little bit like Wayne Rooney, you know, like, you would feel like he always has to be involved in the game. He couldn't just hang on the periphery of it and then burst into life. Well, maybe he could, but he didn't do that. He wanted to be involved. He had to be at the heart of the action, which, for a player with the extravagance of George Best, it's a definite, a different bow to him that, Like we've said, I don't think really gets the appreciation that it deserves.
Yeah, I agree. European Cup was an important part of Best's early career, and we all know about the final in 68. But it was the quarterfinal 2 years earlier against the same opponents he would face in 68, Benfica, which I guess you could argue would catapult Best's stock into the stratosphere. I mean, he was only 19, but he dominated that match. And in those pages, you beautifully tell the story of the match, interposed with relevant quotes. But for me, it was the words of Benfica fullback Antonio, is it Simoes?
Yeah.
I don't know how you pronounce it. Which really lifted. I mean, he really rated George, didn't he? And how did you get to interview him?
I went through Benfica. Benfica were very helpful.
Oh, brilliant.
And Simoes was, to be fair, as soon as he knew that... oh, God. I'm getting emotional thinking about this, Mike, because I told... So he was probably midway through the process that I talked to Simoes. He was so... he thanked me for writing the book.
Wow.
He thanked me. He was like, I'm so grateful that somebody... First of all, he's asking me. But second of all, he's writing this version of George's story because it deserves to be told. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you... I might have put the words to the audio to some video footage and uploaded it. You might have even seen that. Mm-hmm. If you listen to, and that's just a tiny clip of the interview, and his voice is almost breaking.
Yeah.
Because it was the way that he spoke of the fact that it was a privilege to be involved on that first night in 66, mm-hmm. when George did what he did as a 19-year-old. I mean, this was the historic landmark performance by any British player on the continent. This was that moment. Probably, I mean, Gareth Bale had a similar one, you know, against Inter Milan, but even then it wasn't the same because it wasn't the Inter Milan of... The Benfica were almost recently dethroned European champions. They'd won it twice, you know what I mean? They were one of the best teams in Europe. They'd never lost at home. And George did what he did as a 19-year-old. It was the landmark performance. And perhaps it never... When you think about it in those terms, perhaps nobody has ever done anything like that from a British standpoint. You know, it's the landmark British performance on the continent. So... Obviously, everybody appreciated it in the moment. We all knew how big it... Everyone who witnessed it at the time knew how big it was. And ever since that, those of us who've been born and studied history and look back at that, we all recognise how significant it was. But for a player like Simoes to come out of a game where you've lost 5-1, which must have been humiliating, and then still consider it a career highlight because you were... privileged to be involved in something. It's like an England player coming out and saying that they were happy to be on the pitch when Maradona scored. Yeah. They don't do it. They don't do it because they're too proud. They're too proud to admit that they were there at a historic moment in time. And I can't really think of... Maradona and Bess doing that are probably the two seminal performances in football. To my mind, they are. There are probably others. Like, I mean, remember Zidane doing what he did against Leverkusen, you know, in the final.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that, but I don't think that registers on the same scale as Maradona. And they probably, you know, Brazil 1970 in the final and stuff like that. I'm not detracting from that. I'm talking about an individual doing something that just it elevates them above everything else that they've done. And it's the one thing that you can go back to and just think, that's what they did and that's how they changed football as we know it. Because I don't think it... Even Messi and Ronaldo, and I love both of them, I think they're both brilliant. And even Cantona, you know I idolise Cantona.
Yeah.
I don't think any... Those are the two football... You could probably... You're more of a culture buff in terms of global football, so you could probably name three or four after this, but... I just think Maradona and Bess doing what they did on those two nights are so seminal that they sort of surpass everything else. And and the way that he spoke of it, that it was a privilege to be involved was just, you know, and obviously people don't go back and ask the Benfica players, what did you think of George in those games? Because, you know, they might not want to talk about it.
Yeah.
But I thought, no, it's going to add some depth to this story. And as you know from reading the significance of Simoes later on in George's story, he was the right person to pick because nobody else had the story with George that he had.
Mm-hmm.
So to talk to him and to start his story with George on that night was just so rewarding. One of the best experiences I've had writing about football is talking to Antonio Simões. He's just, and he's such a nice guy as well. He's such a nice guy. And I'm not just saying that because he thanked me, because this is a legend of football thanking me that I'm writing about. You know, I like writing about George Best. You know, you don't have to.
I mean, Simões is an accomplished footballer himself. I mean, he played in the 66 World Cup in England. He was obviously in the 68 World Cup final, European Cup final. I mean, he was an accomplished footballer as well. But I think that says a lot about it. And as you said, that interview just elevates it. And Best was only 19. He was only 19. And the only one I could think of immediately is obviously 1958 in Pele in the World Cup.
Oh, yeah. That's the only one I could think of.
But, and the Simões, those who are going to read the book, there's a link to him, of him talking about George throughout the book, which is great. And as you quite rightly said, he was the perfect person to talk about George.
Yeah. Fantastic. Yeah, he really was. Yeah.
So on to May 29th, 1968. The match obviously has huge historical significance, not only to Manchester United, but to English football too. I mean, United had a team which finally won club football's Premier Trophy, but they were also a side that, obviously I'm biased, but they could stand comparison with any in the history of the tournament. It almost felt, and I don't know if this is the right word, disrespectful, that the plaudits were as much about Best as they were about the team. I mean, you know, you've researched, you've written about him. Wayne, did George Best really become that big at that time?
Yeah, I think a lot of it was to do with 66, you know, because he destroyed them basically single-handedly on that night. So obviously that was going to feed into the narrative. But Benfica did as well. They fed into it because they were so terrified. They were planning to put two men. They had two men marking him and a third. So it was the whoever was the third man around was the one who was, you know, he had to be alert as well. So that tells you that they were feeding into it as well. So it wasn't just a case of, yes, he was seen as bigger and perhaps it was slightly disrespectful considering you had two European Player of the Years in the United side. Obviously, Lowe was injured, but disrespectful to that side in that Best was seen as the star name of it, perhaps. But yeah, I mean, the thing is, he was that good and he was that lethal to Benfica because they'd already seen what he could do against two men, you know, so they had to have a third man watching him. And I still think when I watched that back, the 68 final, George beat himself up for that performance. I actually think if you watch it back, he's all right, he's good. When you get past the idea that a player should shine just because he's George Best, and you look at the actual flow of the game and the fact that everyone's always close to him and they're not exactly gentle with their attention to him. And then when you see him come alive, you think, bloody hell, he's doing that even with the attention that is on him. So I actually think he did much better than he thought he did. But
I mean, he created space for others because he attracted people to him and because he could
get
the ball, even though he didn't go past them as he did in previous games and so on. But that could keep the ball created, especially for kid, created a lot of space.
Yeah, and also Aston, because Aston was able to, I mean, by far and away the man of the match, Aston. He absolutely tears down, I think it's Jacinto, isn't it, that he just terrorises him, whoever it is, the fullback, he just destroys him. All game, he's down the line. He's not a dribbler in the way that George was, but he's like Sharp and Giggs, wasn't it? Like he was like Lee Sharp, just bombing down that side and just taking him apart, and he wouldn't have been able to do that without George. I described it as like a sacrifice. At one point in a different game, I described George as a human pinata because he was basically being flogged all over the pitch so the other players could do their thing. That wasn't the Benfica weren't that bad in this game, but they were, like you said, it gives that opportunity for other players to sort of breathe a little bit. And George by this point knew that and he appreciated that. He knew that obviously he wanted to impress himself, but he had that in-game maturity to understand, okay, well, if I move here, then it is going to create spaces for other players. So it wasn't like, you know, when you watch him play and when he gets on the ball, you can see a little bit of the greed there, but that's probably the anxiety to do well. But he was very mature in his in-game movement because it did create a lot of space for other players. It was a strange one. But I do think, though, the Benfica players had a lot of respect for those United players. Firstly, like you said, there were a lot of players who played against them for some of those players in the World Cup, who played probably other games against them as well. So they knew what they were about. I couldn't ever disrespect a player like Bobby Charlton or Nobby Styles, because Styles is going to kick you back twice as hard, and Bobby Charlton is so good that you just couldn't. Even Aston at half time in that game, they must have thought, flipping heck, we're going to have to concentrate a little bit more on keeping this guy quiet as well. Do you know, and you had Sadler as well, a bunch of great players, you know, like Krerend, who was this metronome in the middle, keeping everything going along. So you had all these great players anyway, and they knew. I mean, Benfica were no mugs. Like we said, they won the European Cup twice. They had some of the best players of all time in that team, Eusebio. Yes, they were towards the end of that cycle, but it was still a great Benfica side. And they would have been well aware of the quality of that United team all the way through. It's just that George scared them so much that they had to treat him that way. They had to, because you can already see by George's, I think, pretty decent performance that if they didn't have a player extra on him, he would have run riot.
He would have run riot
because wasn't coming off. He wasn't, you know, frustrated and having a terrible night of it. I mean, a couple of rash decisions, but that's what happens when you're 20, 21, 22. You know, you're going to make those kind of things. He was, I tend to go with that one, Mike, to say that they respected it. They respected the team so much, but because George was so good and he frightened him that much, that he was elevated into this position where it did seem like he was much bigger than the other players. But that's only because of what had happened before.
Fair enough. That final, 1968, we know that was the pinnacle for Matt Busby, and we know Matt, you know, later retired, not soon after. And we know that Best loved United. Now, how much did it hurt him, and how much did his career at United suffer after Samat left, and especially that side wasn't then supplemented with better players? Was that why the highs at the highest level became, I would guess, far less frequent?
Yeah, that was one reason. I mean, there was a few. It was so complicated after that moment, wasn't it? After Matt announced he was going to retire, and then even when he came back for the little spell after McGuinness was sacked, and George was saying to him, stay on, do you know what I mean? He obviously, in a certain way, like, almost fed into it himself, because Busby wasn't going to carry on. It was time to move on, and, you know, there's a different argument about whether or not Busby had the ability to lead for another 6 to 7 years, but he'd accepted that he wasn't going to do it, so everybody had to get ready for change. Everybody had to, you know, and the game was changing to George's benefit.
It was.
Everything was laid out for him, and then there were these moments where he was motivated and where everything seemed to be going. But it's because when you look at the first few months under O'Farrell, where he played as well as he ever did, he scored some of the best goals he ever scored in his career. And then you look at that period of time and you realise that he was doing that, playing some of the best football of his career, and that was just about keeping United competitive. Now, they were leading the league at that point, and I think he was getting frustrated because United were conceding a lot of goals, and it wasn't just the case that, oh, George has scored another hat trick. He was thinking, I've got to score that hat trick or we're not going to win. And the thing is, he was good enough to do it. You know what I mean? That's the frustrating thing when you look at it. United would have, if George had been that motivated and not frustrated with the fact that he was having to do it all, United could have won the league, and George's contribution to winning that league, if it had been the same as it was in the first half, would have been the greatest contribution to any league-winning title, league-winning side in history. it would have been the greatest individual performance in a season. It nearly was anyway because of how good he played in the first half of it. But he grew so frustrated with this, you know, the responsibility that was on him and the fact that he wasn't, I guess, you know, he was being flogged a little bit. You know, he's getting kicked everywhere and sometimes when you go away and you sort of have a few drinks to try and wind down and then you're back in the team and you're a little bit lethargic, then, you know, and you're getting kicked and you can't quite get away in the same way that you start to get a little bit more frustrated as George tended to do. And then he obviously had a few sort of falling outs with O'Farrell. O'Farrell too hesitant. In the way that he, we talked about this in different shows, but yeah. For me, it was obviously the signing. Alex Stepney says this, that he believes if Story Moore and Buchan had been signed in November instead of March, everything would have changed, not only for that season, but probably for United in the 70s and probably for George Best as well. And I think it's a very interesting theory, and it's one that I tend to agree with, because if Buchan had come in and hit the ground running, as he generally did, if they had played him in the middle, and Story Moore was in there to take some of that creative burden away, I'm not that George needed the burden so much, but another body there that people were worried about, that the attention wouldn't be on him all the time, that, you know, you would have seen George become even better. Probably, even better than the guy who scored three goals against West Ham, better than the guy who scored that goal against Sheffield United. He was that good that he would have become even better approaching his peak, and then it all went pear-shaped. And I think that it was just such a complex scenario of that two-year spell where everything just sort of fell away from him, and once the sort of physical aspects of the illness had caught up with him, then it became very difficult to turn that around.
Wayne, the book is brilliant in so many ways, and we've covered quite a lot of it already, but there is a hitherto untold story that you tell for the first time in the chapter entitled Goodbye. Now, how much of it do you want to tell us here, want to tell us? I wouldn't want to spoil it for the reader. Or is it, in fact, better to tease the listeners that there is a story in the book that is so significant that the then future of the club could have turned out very, very differently?
Yeah. I don't know about the latter point, because maybe not. Maybe things were
destined?
Yeah, maybe things at that point were always going to end in the way that they were going to end. Fine. But I'd be interested in your point on this, because I'm the one, I've been saying this a lot, that I think it is the biggest story that hasn't yet been told in United history. Mm-hmm. And this is how far I'll go with talking about it. It's George's exit from United, that involved his, basically, all the wheels were set in motion. He returned from this sort of abstinence, self-imposed retirement. Tommy Docherty brought him back. It didn't go as well as they'd hoped, even though George was still probably the best player in the side. His physical excesses were making that sort of physical flogging even worse in the First Division. And then, how's the best way to articulate it without giving anything away? His last game for United was against QPR. He was supposed to play against Plymouth. There's a story that goes around that he turned up drunk. That's the story that Tommy Docherty says. He turned up drunk, and that's why he didn't pick him for the game against Plymouth. And then he left and never played again. So much of that isn't true. And you know, I've worked with Tommy Docherty when he was alive.
Yeah.
I adored him. It wasn't an easy thing to do, to go down this route. But I did have this story for a couple of years. I had been told it because of, well, you know, the name of the person that's strongly connected to this. So I knew them. I knew the story for a while, but it was kind of like how best do I get this story across, because it's so big, it's not the kind of one that you can just sort of say, oh, by the way, this happened. So it really needed me writing this book for this story to come out. Mm-hmm. Basically, the idea is... you're going to have to edit some of this because I think I'm going down rabbit holes and not quite sure I'm coming up. Anyway, so basically what it was is George wasn't... He didn't turn up for the game drunk. Some people might say, oh, that still happened. I think there's a chain of events that are clearly proven in this book because of the factual evidence. Mm-hmm. It just took a little bit of investigating, got my Columbo out on. The chain of events makes it really unreasonable that it could have happened the way that Doherty said that it did. And it completely corroborates everything that George has said. Now, no matter what, there's always been an element of doubt because Doc's story stands up to some sort of scrutiny because it's believable to think that George turned up for a game drunk. Regardless of how much he denied it and the other players denied it, it's possible that you think, oh yeah, that could have happened. So I was delighted that I exonerated George from that. Not that he probably didn't, would never have thought that I needed to, but I'm glad that I did that once and for all. That's on record now, that it just is so impractical that that could have happened. Mm-hmm. The second thing that comes into it, well, if Doherty is lying, why is he lying?
Yeah.
What motivation does he have for lying? And that story's in the book.
Yeah,
it's absolutely outlined word for word exactly what happened, and you suddenly see things very differently. I did. Because you look at George taking accountability for things going wrong, and you read those words as they were said at the time in 1974, and you suddenly think, you poor guy. Mm. You poor guy. And poor Manchester United fans as well, because you've been... Everyone has been told this story. George took the responsibility of it. That's the thing that gets my... It's the only thing that really... I'm not, you know, upset with Tommy. Maybe Tommy thought that he had to do what he had to do in the same way they did for Dennis Law. But,
it is an important story. And I think, you know, anyone who reads it is going to realise... I mean, I've made my assumptions and my views on it, and you know, I don't really necessarily want to divulge them here. But the point is that it's out there and people are going to have a different view of quite a significant part of United's history in the 70s. And, you know, thank you for that. Thank you for getting it out there and giving us that information. Now, after that, Best lands at different clubs. But it's his time at Fulham, which coincided with Bobby Moore, Rodney Marsh, and you know, people like Tony Gale as well. And George started enjoying himself again. And George was happy then, wasn't he?
He was. He really was. It was a difficult time for him, obviously, because he's having to... His motivation before leaving United was winning First Division Championships and hopefully winning the European Cup, playing in the European Cup and becoming the European Player of the Year. I think the most difficult thing for him and why he took so long away from the game is because he had to redefine what was important to him in the game anymore. So that's where he had that sort of period where it's like, oh, what am I going to do next? How am I going to do anything? And I think what triggered him, what got that motivation back was the NASL and the idea that, you know, Cruyff and Pelé were playing. Mm. Or Pelé was and Cruyff was going to play out there. And so this was the playground of the great players. So you got to remember, it's a very different playing field to as it is today, and the accolades and everything like that, the number of games that are played, the number of games that are shown on television. So this was a chance. It was almost like a super league in a way, because all of the great players were there. You know, like Beckenbauer. It was a real testing ground. Every team had an elite player on them, and George wanted to test himself against those players. So he saw that as the fire. Again, he got the fire because he knew, I can go up against Pelé and I can show him, I can show everyone that in the head-to-head. Because you've got to remember as well, Pelé's career came with its own doubt, you know, that, oh, could he play in Europe? And he never did.
Yeah.
So he went into into the NASL a kind of like an unknown quantity as well. Not an unknown quantity. The guy won World Cups and, like you said, seminal moments himself. Mm. But people were still asking the question, just as they were of George Best at that time. So George wanted to go up against him and just say, look, I'm better than him and I can show that. So that sort of reignited that fire. And it was because he was proving himself and he was doing so well, he thought, do you know what, I think I could go back to England and, mm-hmm. and show how good I am. But obviously you had the other clubs who were a little bit reluctant to take a chance on him. So this is how the Fulham opportunity came up. And obviously you had Moore and Marsh there as well. And yeah, it did for a while because he just played to... I mean, I talked to Rodney Marsh for the book and they probably had different objectives. Like, Marsh played to entertain. George did as well, but he wanted to win. He really wanted to win. And I think he thought that Fulham could get to the FA Cup final, you know, if he just stayed there, because he really wanted to play in an FA Cup final. That was the one thing missing from, you know, he had these massive Wembley ambitions. He played there too few times, really. But so he had this desire to prove himself again. And obviously in that time he came up against Cruyff. He was recalled to the Northern Ireland team after a number of years. I mean, this is the thing about George's career after United, is that everyone says, oh, it's a downward spiral and that this is the wasteland of his career. But if you talk to the players that played with him, you talk to the fans who watched him, they were the glory days for their team. Do you know what I mean? It's not a terrible thing at all. And he certainly did. I mean, he had some great moments there. Everyone talks about the Hereford game. I think my favourite one is the goal. I actually posted it to Twitter a few days ago, where against Oldham, where a few United fans were there because their game at QPR had been postponed. So they all travelled to Fulham to watch Oldham get battered 5-0. And George scored one of the goals, a fabulous chipping off the bar. A little bit of, you know, like, lasting memory. I had a few people telling me on Twitter the other day that, I mean, after I posted it, that, you know, they were there to see it. And it's just nice to sort of share that moment with fans. But, yeah, that was George at that moment, motivated again. But then again, when Moore and Marsh went, and he was the one sort of propping up a second division side, the disparity in quality was even more pronounced.
Too great. What comes out from reading the book, Wayne, is the love people have of George. I mean, there's a passion and a respect for his football and his football talent, but also genuine affection for the man. I mean, he was well-liked, wasn't he?
Yeah, and I think that's to do with, it, you know, the different side of his personality. Everyone sees the controversial side, but the thoughtful side, the kind side, the generous version of George Best. Yes, he had his flaws, but by all accounts, he was just a nice person to be around, a generous person with his time as well. You know, to my mind, I've gone on record as saying it, the greatest player that ever lived, and even with that, he was still willing to give his time to anyone and talk to them. Not in a way that, you know, he'd just stand on a street corner and talk to people, but if they wanted to talk to him, he would never make them feel like they were beneath him. Mm-hmm. So that obviously comes across in the way that people speak of him. Tony Gale, for example, played in midfield with him for a few games at Fulham and speaks of him as if like he's the best friend that he ever had. Do you know what I mean? The experience of playing with him was so rich for him, as it would be. But the way that George was so generous, I mean, helping him. George wasn't a central midfielder by any stretch of the imagination, no. But they played in midfield together. Yeah. And Tony attributes, he says a lot of praise for the way that George helped his game. So it tells you everything about how good George was as a player, that he was able to help Tony as a midfielder when he didn't even play that position himself.
Brilliant, brilliant. Wayne, my favourite chapter comes near the end where you call it Sombrero. It is where you and your writing, for me, is at the best, where there is ample conjecture, but also backed up by qualified justification. You weave these, I'm going to call them chains of analysis that make the reader think, make the reader wonder. Isn't that what books should be for?
Yeah, I guess so. Thank you. I did That was an element. Probably the most I got involved with the other side of George's life is in that chapter, because I felt I took the gloves off a little bit, because I'd spent that much time with him writing it up until that. I would say with him, I'm talking about in spirit, the person George Best, the footballer George Best. I'd spent this entire journey, and I felt I watched all this footage, and then when I'd gone through it all and I'd seen, you know, I was very careful in the way that I talked about his illness, always making sure I was referencing it as an illness, that by the time I got to that point of the book, and I'm writing it, I'm thinking, I was actually angry on his behalf by some of the things that happened to him. I'm not saying he absolutely was not blameless at all, because, you know, there are certain things that he did that, you know, he shouldn't have done. And I'm never going to sort of justify why he did it just because he was the best footballer ever. But this book wasn't about that. And it was about sort of understanding the effect. When I came to this point in the book, I was understanding the impact the illness had, but also the way that he was hung out by society and the people who wanted to benefit from his celebrity, but also wanted to hurt him at the same time. And I honestly found that incomprehensible. And I wanted to put that on record, just that, and also these different ways of describing his greatness and talking about him in context with other people, humanizing him at the same time as talking about him as a family person who, you know, was so closed in by celebrity that he couldn't go to funerals of family members. Do you know, because of the respect that he had for the family, he didn't want them to be under the same kind of scrutiny that he was under. And that was a very, very different kind of existence for George Best in the post-playing career. It must have been very difficult for him, and I just wanted to sort of, without sort of taking the blame away from him completely, I wanted to try and put that in a little bit of context as well.
And I think you do that very well. Wayne, what's your favourite part of the book?
Possibly that. I enjoyed writing that part. Like I said, some of the glove came off, especially that sort of like the way that he talks about when Parkinson talks about, you know, he had him on the interview when he said something like, where did it all go wrong?
Yes.
I felt it was a really good storytelling, and like I should thank Parky for that, because he provided me with this like real dichotomy of you can talk about it in two or three different ways, and the way that you can see George sort of like, no, I don't want to tell the story again, and then eventually he tells the story again, and it's like, no, you know, that explains so much about him. But I think the sort of talking to Simoes, it was a great thing. Talk about his youth team days, you know, with John Fitzpatrick and Eddie Harrop and Jimmy Rimmer. Those kind of things were great, because those kind of stories haven't really been told before. So the entire process of writing it was great, really. But I think the Simoes one, I really enjoyed my own writing. I really felt improved in some of the writing of this book. I really enjoyed writing about the final itself. Some of the goals, like I said, really went to town on writing about some of them. The Sheffield United goal, the West Ham goal, and the Chelsea goal where Harris tries to kill him. And then the final passage of the book as well. Probably, like, I would say the final passage of the book, because I had an idea of what I wanted to do with the way that I wanted to conclude it. And when we did the read-through, you know, after the first edit, me and my wife did the read-through, and sometimes you can think, oh, we've ended it too soon. You know what I mean? It's just another few pages, but it just felt right. Do you know what I mean? That's the way that my version of a George Best story should end, the way that I told it in that last two or three pages. So to have that idea of what I wanted to do with it and the way that it ended up, I was really proud that it came about in that way rather than changing it. Do you know what I mean? I could have easily changed it at some point, but I was just really happy with that. So the various points that I'm really happy with, and I just hope that that's the way they, yeah, they comes across.
I will say it. There's some wonderful photos of George in the book. I mean, you shared them with me. And one favourite of mine is one title, I think it's titled Poetry in Motion, which perfectly captures his balance as a footballer with a ball at his feet. And that's what he's written, renowned for. How much say did you have in the photos that were used? And is there one that you favour?
Let me get the book in front of me. Yeah, I think it's funny because I just opened it up on the Poetry's Motion. But yeah, I love that one. Possibly that one, to be fair. I did have a say. The great thing about working with Reach, and I will say this, they've done a magnificent job with this book. I mean, the presentation of it, Mike, you know, your copy's in the post, and
brilliant.
You'll see it's absolutely magnificent. It's beautiful. And they, you know, they went through the pictures. They gave me a presentation, you know, showed me the pictures that they were intending to use. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I could have objected, but they were just so good. They've got a great archive, obviously, because their titles include the Daily Mirror, and they've got like a decades long archive, and it's so good, such a good archive. And the pictures that they chose were so fitting for this book. I mean, the editor, Chris Brereton, I've got to say a word for him, because he was very complimentary of this very early on. He sent me messages, you know, saying how much he was enjoying working on it, and I think he had the majority hand in picking the pictures. He just seemed like he was connecting really well with the story, and I just thought it's perfect what he did, and they're just the perfect representation for this this version of George's story, really.
And the cover, beautiful cover. I mean, you shared it with me, you know, months ago, and it's you know, when you did the unboxing and you put it on your social media outlets, it was, I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking for every time the postman knocks, I'm thinking, is that it?
That was what I was like for 2 days. Yeah. So yeah.
Wayne, nearly there. Some general questions about the book. I'm going to ask you the same question I asked you when we spoke about your book on Cantona and Beckham. Can you give me one sentence to describe what George Best means to you?
Yeah, he was the greatest footballer that the world has ever seen, and he was the physical rebirth of the spirit of Manchester United.
Wow, beautiful. And if you could have sat down with George, what two questions would you ask him?
Oh God! Narrowing it to two, I'd probably ask you, because she's so good with your questions. I might get what two questions have you got for George? I would probably test the waters and just see, you know, what, because he did say once or twice that, oh, the problem is, where has it gone wrong with my football? And I talked to John Roberts, his former ghostwriter for the book, and he said that it was simply that the team weren't good enough and he wanted them to strengthen. That's where he came down to with it. And it probably is that, because, I mean, you can't get too complicated with football. It's so bound by its boundaries. You know, it's not like, you know, he wanted to play a 9-man attacking formation or anything like that. It's obviously going to be within the confines of what a normal footballing situation is. So it was likely that when he says it went wrong with his football, what he means is it went wrong when United fell away and they didn't sort of strengthen from the position where they should have strengthened. So I probably would ask him that, because I think it's such an obvious question that you couldn't get away with it, but I'd push him on it, you know, to try and actually get the full complicated explanation for why. And also, I'd probably like to talk to him about the 68 final. Maybe not, I had to ask a direct question, but he seemed to, you know, he felt it was an anticlimax. Why? You know, he was such an intelligent footballer. Why couldn't he have understood that? Maybe that is just the nature of someone who's that brilliant, a perfectionist, because we've all been there where we've done something that we think is good, but it's just got a tiny flaw in it. Do you know what I mean? And you think, oh, I feel really let down by that. I mean, he scored the most important goal in Manchester United history. It won them the European Cup. and he was disappointed with his performance. But you watch it back and you think, no, there were flashes of brilliance in there. And he did, you know, without spoiling one of the main narrative themes of the book, he did something that he always intended of doing in that final. It just didn't happen precisely the way that he wanted it to. But in a game of football, it went as close to plan as anything can. Why could you not be content with that? Do you know what I mean? What was it that? What is it within those kind of scenarios that made you? You know, if we can really break it down and think, it went pretty well. Why? What could have gone better for you? What you know? Is it simply a case of Benfica, like, deciding to ease up on you for a night?
Yeah, Wayne. Finally, what's next for you? Any new projects you want to tell our listeners about?
Well, there's Sunshine Kids, which will be published in August, which is the autobiography of Rafael and Fabio da Silva. Such an incredible project to work on. Very different from a normal autobiography because it's told in both of their voices. Sir Alex Ferguson has already provided a foreword for that.
Oh, wow.
And it includes one of... I mean, they both cried when they read the foreword. It includes one of the best lines that will ever feature in one of my books because it came from Fergie, basically. But, you know, they got really upset about it in a good way. So, yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. And there are some things. I mean, I don't know when you are going to have the time to rush edit this podcast to come out, Mike, but in the next few weeks, you know, I talked to you informally about some of these things that are happening.
Yes.
I can't really go public on because it's not my place to go public on, but a lot of that stuff's going to come out very shortly because of the nature of the timing of these things. And, you know, one thing I can say is, you know, I've been asked to write a book on Wayne Rooney because of his recent retirement. So I've been working hard at that. That's since I closed on the George book in November, pretty much from the second Wayne retired, I've been working hard for 2 or 3 months, so literally 24 hours, but around the clock on this book, like working really, really hard on it. So it's been kind of good to keep the anxiety of this book at bay, do you know what I mean? But now I'm sort of coming close to the end of the first edit of that and, that, you know, ramping up for all the promotion that's going to come with this book, that I'm sort of taking a break from Rooney for a little bit and going back to George Best.
Excellent. Do you want to tell our listeners, you know, when the book is released and how they can interact with you on social media?
Yeah, sure. It's Thursday, April the 8th is the official release date of the book. They can get it on all the usual places, Amazon, Waterstones. Obviously, the stores will be back open in the UK a few days after that. If you're a worldwide listener, I think you can get it on Book Depository. I think they're doing free international shipping. I don't quote me on that, but it looks like a good offer. Also, Reach Sport, the publisher, they're also doing really reasonable rates on international shipping at the moment. And finally, it's actually, I think it's been picked up by Asda, you know, the supermarket.
Okay, nice.
So they don't often pick up sports books, but this is one that's obviously George Best. It's such a big name that I think they're taking a chance on it. So it may well be that from Thursday that you can pop into your local Asda and while you're waiting for them to create your pizza, you can go and pick up a George Best book.
Brilliant, brilliant. Wayne, thanks for coming on the show again. Thanks for sharing your thoughts, and as always, it's been a pleasure. And before I go, I want to give the listeners my views on the book, as I always do. Here we go. Finding quotes, articles and books on George Best is difficult. There's plenty out there. And there are plenty of video clips too. What True Genius by Wayne Barton gives the reader is a very accessible, very readable, well packaged and expertly researched account of George Best's football career. Yes, there's information about his life off the pitch, but it is what he does once he crossed the white line, which is analysed here, and is in this sphere of influence which Wayne Barton, like his subject, excels in by expertly putting across why Best was, well, the best. With so much new content in the form of fresh interviews, it really is a definitive account of one of football's true footballing superstars. As is Wayne's trademark, his personal views on the subject is backed up with excellent research, which is intertwined with relevant and carefully told stories and well-placed quotes. And this is why this book does best talent justice. The description of some of his most fated goals are brilliant. The tension describing some of the matches is building. And then there is the never-before-told story, a true wow moment. Wherever Best went, he left an indelible and memorable mark. And for me, there is a lovely symmetry here, as whatever this author puts his mind and word processes to, there is also a notable and praiseworthy outcome. And as you can tell, I'm a fan. True genius George Best is a historical account of the best player to have played for Manchester United. It is also the celebration of a footballer who had incredible talent. Having chronicled who he believes is the most important person in the club's history, Jimmy Murphy, the club's most important player, Eric Cantona, Wayne has scored a hat-trick in his tome on United's best player. What's next in the series, if there is one? I don't know. But with this book, Barton solidifies his reputation. Whether there's a conscious desire to want to be the best is unclear, given his humble personality. But as a reader and a fan of his writing, I unashamedly want to say that Barton, like Best, shares a moment where what he's doing is peerless. Buy the book, see what I mean, and you too will become a fan. This has been Mike Pieri. You've been listening to Shoot the Defence, and you can find us on Twitter at Shoot the Defence, and my Twitter is at Del Pieri. And until next time, goodbye.